A very warm welcome to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. For the next hour, we'll be checking in with our correspondents across the globe, hearing the voices behind the words that make the pages of Monocle.
Coming up, how Alpine Design is making its mark on our supermarket aisles.
And why luxury yacht makers claim to be tightening their belts.
And we hear what it's like to interview an accordion-playing national icon.
All that right here at Midori House.
This is Monocle 24 News. I'm Nick Kelly. Rescuers pulled a two-week-old baby girl alive from the wreckage of a collapsed apartment block today as they battled to find survivors from an earthquake that hit eastern Turkey that killed at least 432 people and left thousands homeless. The baby's mother and a grandmother were also brought out alive on stretchers to jubilant cries from onlookers who followed the dramatic rescue under cold, pouring rain. However, hope of finding more people alive under tons of rubble faded with every passing hour as rescuers pulled out more bodies. News just in, gunshots were heard as prisoners set fire to a jail and fought with guards in Turkey's quake-hit city of Van today, 2 days after a jailbreak when 200 were reported to have escaped chaos after the major earthquake in Turkey. The Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's main coalition partner has said the government could fall over plans to raise the retirement age a day before a deadline to present an urgent economic reform plan to the European Union. EU leaders, led by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the French President Nicolas Sarkozy, have demanded that Berlusconi present firm plans to promote growth and reduce Italy's massive debt in time for the summit meeting in Brussels tomorrow. The euro slid from a six-week high today after the cancellation of a European finance ministers' meeting that raised doubts about an EU summit that would deliver a comprehensive plan to contain the region's debt crisis. With Wednesday's European Union leaders' summit still scheduled to take place, expectations of a broad agreement were tempered by fears any accord could lack details and disappoint markets. Egypt's prestigious seat of Sunni learning, Al-Azhar, has said the dead should be respected and buried, a clear criticism of how the ousted Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's body was put on show for days after his killing. Gaddafi was buried in a secret location in the desert today, 5 days after he was captured, killed and put on grisly public display, a move that provoked controversy among Islamic scholars over its religious legality. Meanwhile, the interim oil and finance minister has said Libya's oil output has risen to 500,000 barrels a day, boosted by fresh flows from Spain's Ashurara field. And the United States is optimistic about an eventual return to six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear program. That's according to the chief U.S. negotiator. 2 days after meetings with North Korean negotiators, Ambassador Stephen Bosworth, U.S. Special Representative for North Korea, said differences had been narrowed, but did not reveal specifics of the talks with the senior North Korean negotiators. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Now let's take a look at the global weather. Here's Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And the relatively mild weather continues across Europe with spells of rain and sunny moments too, so a real autumnal mix. What we're currently seeing is mild air originating from the Mediterranean and spilling across most of the European continent from Switzerland to Norway. So whether you live in Zurich or Oslo, the air outside is actually from the Med. But it's Western Europe where we're feeling the warmest of the weather. Now we've had some flooding rains here in the UK in the past day or so. Tuesday and Wednesday will also be very wet in Corsica, Sardinia, Sicily and Italy. So quite a wet outlook. Here's a city forecast for Tuesday into Wednesday. Oslo, rain by Wednesday, 8 Celsius here. In London, mostly sunny, but one or two showers too, 14 degrees Celsius. In Frankfurt, some sunshine, 15 degrees the high. And in Rome, be prepared for that rain on Wednesday, but still highs getting up to 19 degrees. Now, as far as air travel goes, there is a fair bit of heavy weather out there in the Atlantic. Turbulent clouds and a complicated jet stream close to the UK, meandering not just from a west to east direction, but from a south to north direction as well. That's all the way from Spain to Iceland. So flights may have to cut through some of this heavy weather. If you're flying off to the US, you'll probably fly south of Greenland eventually, which is looking fairly quiet, but then more turbulent weather lurking on approach to Canada. and the United States. And let's head to North America now. First of all, a lot of warm weather through Tuesday and Wednesday across the southern and the southeastern states, from Texas, Georgia, all the way to Maryland. At the same time, across the Rockies, the first signs of some stormy weather brewing, and this stormy weather is expected to head in the direction of the eastern seaboard over the next couple of days, an ugly weather outlook heading for New York later on in the week. Here's your Business Centre weather forecast then, Tuesday into Wednesday, and New York City still looks sunny on Tuesday. By Wednesday, clouds and showers on the increase, the high 16 in New York. For Washington DC, warm and sunny, 21 the high. In Dallas, now this is where the heat is on, 30 degrees Celsius, hot sun, but a thunderstorm chance here. And in San Francisco, tons of sun for the rest of the week and highs of 20 Celsius. Again, air travel across the US, a fair bit of heavy weather flying in the direction of Europe, for example. So if you're flying out of Chicago or Toronto, could be bumpy early in the journey as you fly across the eastern part of Canada and the far northeast of the United States. A strong jet stream here. And finally, a look at some other world destinations for Wednesday. Cape Town is looking sunny at 21 Celsius and staying sunny all week here. Dubai, also sunny with plenty of desert heat at 35 Celsius. Kuala Lumpur, the typical tropical weather with highs of 32 degrees, sun and occasional tropical showers. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The Propa Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Det Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK time, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
And a warm welcome back to Midori House here at Monocle 24. We'll be bringing you just a first look at the stories making news in the Asia-Pacific region. And Tyler, you're going to tell us about what's happening in Japan.
I am, just as soon as I put down my coffee, because I'm trying to fortify. As much as you've been fortifying yourself, because you're struggling with that cold, which is lurking around Marylebone.
Battling bravely.
Yes. Well, you've got a nice cozy jumper on. I should have done the same before coming into this deep freeze. Before I get to my coffee, a couple of interesting things, and maybe we'll start in Japan. The Daily Yomiuri has two pieces. One, which I think is quite interesting. Tokyo's waterways eyed for emergencies and evacuations, saying Tokyo is investing in its waterways as a practical evacuation resource in the wake of natural disaster like this year's tsunami, which I think is a wise idea. Interesting that not interesting and perhaps not even surprising the Japanese are being so proactive, but a very clever piece, I thought.
Well, by all accounts, what they're doing is that they realise that in the March the 11th disaster, everything was paralysed. So the trains obviously ground to a halt, roads ground to a halt. And so they thought, hang on, we've got all these waterways in the middle of it all. And these waterways have been used for centuries for trade and are currently being used for tourism. And they're taking the Yakata Bune leisure boats and they're thinking, right, well, what can we do with these? Mm. They've got 200 of them knocking around and they have their own generators on them. So they could be used as either shelters or they could either be used as an emergency shelter or could be used to transport people away. The difficulty is, the only hitch is that there is a management discrepancy between the people who own the boats and the people who own the docks, and that's why they weren't used last time, because no one knew what to do. But,
yeah.
You're very well acquainted with the waterways of Tokyo, so how would this work?
Well, I'm often amazed because you get these passing glances of these canals and waterways all over Tokyo, and I always think it's one of the curious things about the city is that Tokyo is very inward looking, and it's only when you go to Odaiba where they've tried to develop the harbour, and I'm constantly surprised that there isn't more development along the waterfront, even where you see these canals, you know, snaking through, you know, the deepest parts of the city. So it's a great measure, I think, because it will also, I think, stimulate developers, I think, to also look at what else they can do to also commercialize these waterways. Another interesting piece as well, also to the Yomiuri, it's talking about, it says Haneda Airport far from international, a shortage in nighttime services and a small number of departure and arrival slots at Japan's Haneda Airport means it is a long way to go before it can be considered a truly international hub. I think this is a very timely and quite important piece of criticism, because We had, you know, considerable coverage in the magazine about the opening of Haneda's international terminal, which has been brilliantly executed. But the problem is that during, let's say, typical hours when airports would be at their busiest, i.e. sort of 9 till 9 o'clock in the evening, those hours are really reserved just for, let's say, mid-haul Asian flights. Long-haul flights are restricted to taking off almost, you know, before sunrise and then late into the evening. So there is this sort of big debate about how international Haneda can really be if it's still
internally at the times when people would find it most convenient to fly.
Yeah, it's still hemmed in by a myriad problems typical of Japanese bureaucracy. It's a great hub, and I think they really sort of need to get off their seats in Japan.
What's its potential?
Well, the potential is huge because they've just built a new runway. There's talk that there'll now be a fifth runway at the airport as well. The great advantage compared to other, major Asian business hubs is that Haneda, if you land at the right time, I mean, you can be at your meeting in 12 to 15 minutes. It is quite literally in the center of the city,
right.
And I think that they really need to be seizing this advantage.
Right. Okay. Well, I've also got. I'm moving on to China now for the looking at the early papers for what Asia is waking up to tomorrow morning. It's Wednesday morning. There's a warning about how the Chinese economy isn't doing particularly well, which surprised me when I first read it, because the only thing that you read at the moment is how it's non-stop growth, and the only thing that can slow them down is if they capitulate with the US's demands to devalue their currency. But there's an article in the People's Daily in China saying that there are three things that are slowing down China's economy. One of them is that there's not as much inward investment, consumption's going down, and also the import-export market is slowing. Now, those are the three things which I would imagine would be absolute linchpins to China's economy.
Absolutely. The other thing, too, is that there's a lot of talk as well that that China's energy reserves and just, the power plants that run the nation are definitely going to be stretched this winter. Yeah, and what's the interesting contrast to all of this is that we saw reports yesterday, I think it was in the China Daily, still saying that we've seen the fifth record month of output from the country. So it's a lot of interesting compare and contrast we're seeing.
It was the highest highest amount of manufacturing was the Chinese turned out in it hit a 5-month high in October, which is an absolute. After 3 months of contraction, is obviously a sign that things are going up.
Well, they have to get all those toys to market. Christmas is around the corner, don't they?
I'm already making a list.
Lots of things that the wheels can fall off of.
Not at all. But their consumer price index has been going up. But also, apparently, this article in the People's Daily is mentioning that as if here in Europe this isn't bad enough, the real estate market's collapsing. Well, not collapsing, but it's slowing down because the Chinese authorities have placed restrictions on investment. And it just sounds so contradictory now that we all thought that China was doing incredibly well.
Yeah.
And now, could the housing market go down again?
Exactly. The Jungong Daily, we're jumping to Korea now, has an interesting story. I'm wondering how much of this is a little bit of domestic PR. It says, survey shows that Seoul gets under your skin. More and more Seoul residents are beginning to regard the city as their hometown, despite coming from other parts of the country. A survey of 46,000 residents has shown. When I see that story, I sort of wonder, what were they trying to determine from all of this? Was it to make local government feel good? Because we're in the middle of elections there.
Right.
Mayor Oh is leaving office, and I'm not sure to sort of what the end gain will be from all of this. But anyway, that's the Jungong.
Well, stay with us on Monocle 24 on Midori House, because when we come back, we will be staying in Seoul, but we'll be taking a trip to a love hotel. Back after this.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programs you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, imagine the situation. You're young, you're in love, you still live with your parents. We've all been there. In Korea, though, there's a solution. Love hotels, which can be hired out by the hour, by the day, if you want. And they've become increasingly popular, even for those who, well, don't want to do the do. Here's our Ted Kravitz doing his best to get people to talk about love hotels.
Ask a local in Japan or Korea about love hotels, or motels as they're more widely known, and this is the response you're likely to receive.
Exotic, for want of a better word.
There's really no need to be embarrassed. The concept of the love hotel is well known throughout Asia, and they've even caught on in South America, rooms rented by the hour or a little longer by couples seeking a little privacy. Even though these kind of motels originated in Japan and even date back to the Edo period of the 17th century, it's Korea that's seen a rise in the number of new establishments. Young adults typically live with their parents until they're married. The increasing cost of education and the low wages earned by graduates in their first jobs make buying or renting their own apartments nearly impossible. So the motel offers a venue to be together outside the family home. And to those used to the conventions of Western hotels, they're really quite something, as I discovered when I stayed in one recently and took a walk outside. Just on this small strip here, we come across the Motel Opera, a picture of the Sydney Opera House on its logo, but an outside more suited to a Doric villa on the Regent's Park in London. Not too dissimilar is the Utopia Motel, Michelangelo's David and the Venus de Milo in huge relief on the side of the building, while what looks like the dome of the Capitol building on top. But it's only when you actually look inside these motels that you really get a feeling for what they're all about. When you open the door to the Orange Motel, you hear Fur Elise. There's a little alarm to alert the owners. Transactions are made through a little hatch. You pay your money, you pick up your key, and you go to your room. Even the lift thanks you for coming in. Once you do get into the privacy of your own room in the motel, we are greeted by quite a host of amusing design features. There's a sparkly floor, and the first thing you really notice is the abundance of mirrors. The wallpaper is completely kitsch, pink butterflies with red stripes, and there's a small picture of a kitten on the wall just to make you feel affectionate for those kind of things. And then you get to the bed itself. It has a bed sheet supplied by the motel, but no covers or anything to sleep under. That's because most patrons don't come here to sleep, but there are some exceptions.
Mind the gap between the train and the platform.
A few days and around 5,000 miles later, I'm back on the tracks to find one of those exceptions. New Malden is the epicentre of London's Korean community. There are no motels here, not yet at least, but I've come to gain a little insight from a Brit who spent a lot more time in a motel than most.
My name is Ben Moll, I'm a photographer, and when I was in Korea I was a teacher. Renting a place was difficult for various reasons, so my only option really was to stay in a love motel. I was there for 6 months, in the end, 6 or 7 months I think. Yeah, it was a very, very happy time. I met a tremendous variety of people from all parts of Korean society who were passing through. Just learned a lot about the country through the people I met. From the outside, they're very ornate, aren't they? I found that most of them seem to be made from plaster, I think, you know, very quickly erected. And financially it was my only option, really, and I'm thankful it was, because I think it was a lot more interesting than staying in a more expensive hotel, I would have thought.
How much did it cost?
After negotiation and staying a little bit longer than I initially thought I would, it was £5 a night. So very reasonable, really, £35 a week.
At prices like that, you might wonder how the motels make money. The secret is in utilisation. Just like a successful restaurant will turn tables, the business case for motels is all about turning rooms. While standard hotels will sell one room per night for 150,000 Korean won, around £100, so the motels can sell a room five times over in that same 24-hour period for between 30 and 50,000 won, around £20 to £30 a go. And it seems the concept is catching on. Earlier this year, New Zealand's first love motel opened on Auckland's North Shore, with elaborately themed rooms ranging from Parisian Moulin Rouge through Cleopatra's palace to a Roman villa. The idea is all about good, clean fun, transforming the guest experience from the functional to the affordably luxurious. And in Japan and Korea, the taboo is slowly lifting. Groups of kids are now taking rooms to do homework together, play computer games, or just watch the latest Justin Bieber DVDs. Love motels? You bet they do. Perhaps soon, we'll feel more comfortable talking about them too.
And that was Ted Kravitz reporting from Seoul and also South Melbourne as well. I wonder how many people have already developed business plans and gone and spoken to their bankers to say, I'd like to open up one of these in New York, or there's room for them in London. And not just for the reasons discussed, but we were talking about Haneda Airport and its flights that come in at odd hours. And I think there's definitely room for hotels. You just want to have a 3 or 4 hour nap, miss trains, all of those. I always feel sorry for Nick Kelly in the evening as well.
I know.
What happens if he misses his train? He doesn't want to go check into an expensive hotel. He just have room for 4 or 5 hours.
There's a nice Kofi sofa upstairs at Midori House. Well, I get the impression that some low-budget hotels obviously offer that service for the reasons that the South Koreans are so embarrassed about. But also the modern, let's say the orange-branded cheaper hotels always gave the impression that they could offer a sort of a more sleep-orientated experience. But what astonished me about that item was the fact that the South Koreans still have this terrible public shame about explaining to Ted, the correspondent, about this sort of shameful aspect of something which is part and parcel of culture. I was just doing a little bit of reading beforehand, and apparently that a South Korean magazine did an article last year where it just simply printed the pictures of 10 love hotels, just the exterior. Mm. Didn't tell them what was going on. Mm. Didn't sort of give any indication of what what might be associated with it. And apparently, local people went absolutely berserk because there was this shame associated of telling foreigners what the South Koreans might just be up to. And if you read about that, I think Ted mentioned there in that report that he was talking about kids doing their homework there. Mm. There have actually been protests when a love hotel has popped up around the corner from a school, because apparently, despite the age restrictions on the entry to these places, mums and dads aren't too chuffed about their children having the option of the teenage children going to experiment round the corner when they come home.
No, doing much more than just watching Justin Bieber. I was also thinking as well how the Japanese or the Koreans would feel if a love hotel that opened, whether it was New Zealand or the UK or the US, mm. would also start appropriating various architectural cues, because from Japan or Korea, because oftentimes it is true, when he talked about either the Doric or Corinthian columns, there's oddly, especially in Japan, there's all these kind of strange classical associations, or it feels
yes.
like you've been into some nasty sort of Disneyfied version of of Renaissance Florence or something. So it would be interesting to see how the Japanese would feel if they sort of took the Edo period and sexified it.
The Japanese have been pushing that some of the Japanese love hotels look like the outside of castles.
There's a big turret theme for sure.
If we were going to open one in London,
I wonder about the symbolism there.
The discretion wouldn't be a terribly discreet place to go, would it?
Should we go away for a short little break?
Let's do that. Back in a minute.
And you're back with it. That was very quick. It's why don't we have a little bit of a song? This is the Alpines. The song is Drive. That was the Alpines with the song Drive. I think if I was driving through an alpine environment, I might drive off the road if I was listening to that. Anyway, we got out of that one early. What's wrong over there?
Nothing. Tyler, tell us about a film that you're going to tell me about and put us out of our misery.
Tell us how we really feel. Sorry about that. Anyway, no, we did a piece, in fact, about this wonderful little hotel called 9 Hours,
right,
which is a small property in Kyoto. And they sell capsule spaces, but not the capsule hotel of the 1970s. It's been, you know, tarted up, and it's got a completely sort of new look and feel to it. And it was a beautiful little film that our Gabriel Lee, who's now based out in Hong Kong,
yeah,
he made this for us some time ago. And it's two things. One, from a design point of view, it's fantastic. And
how so? When you said it's got a new feeling to it, what is it?
Well, part of it just is the way they've done the wayfinding and navigation when you go in. So of course, you know, there's a small little locker for your shoes, so you check your shoes when you go in, and you get your capsule. But then, of course, you don't have your own bathroom. So then they just have all of the packaging, all of the design, the way they've thought about, you know, everything from toothbrushes to the earplugs that you would get, and the slippers, and also pajamas as well. So I mean, it's a very civilized experience.
It's a comprehensive, complete experience.
Yes, and it's designed for sleep, so it's very different than the type of hotel we were talking about earlier. And it could be just the kind of gig for you, Mr. Kelly, don't you
get
think?
Some, I was going to say, get some here.
I know, we've got enough room in the parking lot out here.
We go on the train every time.
Definitely.
So cruel, lets you go home. Shopping shouldn't be allowed.
And on that note, before we let you get, well, you've got a few hours before you get on the train, maybe tell us what's happening at the bottom of the hour here.
All right. Thank you, Tyler and Emma. About 400 people protested in the Tunisian capital today, alleging that the Islamist Ennahda party and other groups had used fraud to win votes in yesterday's election. Rescuers pulled a 2-week-old baby girl alive from the wreckage of a collapsed apartment block today as they battle to find survivors from the earthquake in eastern Turkey that has killed 432 people and left thousands homeless. The Yemeni government and dissident General Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar signed a ceasefire today. Both sides agreed to release people kidnapped during months of protests that have pushed the Arabian Peninsula country to the brink of civil war. The Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's main coalition partner has said the government could fall over plans to raise the retirement age a day before a deadline to present an urgent economic reform plan to the European Union. The euro slid from a 6-week high on Tuesday after the cancellation of a European finance minister's meeting raised doubts an EU summit would deliver a comprehensive plan to contain the region's debt crisis. Chancellor Angela Merkel appealed to German lawmakers from all parties on Tuesday to back plans to boost the firepower of the eurozone rescue fund in a vote set to take place hours before Wednesday's crunch EU summit. Colonel Gaddafi was buried in a secret location in the desert 5 days after he was captured, killed and put on grisly public display, a move that provoked controversy among Islamic scholars over its religious legality. Somali gunmen have kidnapped 2 Western aid workers in northern Somalia, the second capture of aid workers working in the region this month. Amnesty International has issued a scathing report on the Dominican Republic, saying its national police force was responsible for killing and torturing with impunity. And the United States is optimistic about an eventual return to 6-party talks on North Korea's nuclear program, the chief U.S. negotiator said today, after 2 days of meetings with North Korean negotiators. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. The time is just coming up to 32 minutes past the hour. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. In the next half hour, we'll head to the Italian Alps to find out how a family's made shelving a design essential right across the world. But first, very little is known about a lady called Yvette Honor and her accordion outside her home country of France. But she's a national icon in France. She's now in her late 80s and she's in a nursing home, but she is showing no signs of putting down her squeeze box or giving up the bright orange hair dye that you need only really to turn to page 68 of our November issue, and there you'll get the full colour hit of what this lady looks like. Well, here on Midori House, we'd like to find out how the articles made it to the printed page. So, fingers crossed, we have Pamela Druckerman. She met Yvette Honor a few weeks ago and she joins us on the line from Paris. A very good afternoon, good evening to you, Pamela.
Hello, Emma.
Just tell us a little bit about how you managed to get to see this French icon. You had to get quite friendly with her press person, didn't you?
I did. She's 88 years old. She lives in this nursing home in the sort of far reaches of Paris. And I guess I expected something a little bit more glamorous, But I got there, and it's a sort of normal nurse. She's this national icon, but she lives in this very kind of almost drab place. So it was a little bit sad. I was surprised.
But I imagine she strikes quite a glamorous figure inside this drab place.
She is.
I mean, describe her to me, because it's quite hard, unless you have a picture of her in front of it, to really get the full colour hit of this lady's hair. Just explain a little bit how this woman presented herself to you.
She has, I would say, sort of very curly / frizzy electric orange hair, and she wears bright red lipstick and sort of fingers full of gold rings, and she's a stout woman, and she looks you straight in the eye, and she just immediately starts talking about the accordion. She's an iconic figure. It's funny, I asked her, do you play for, I guess I had a sort of bucolic image of what life was like in her retirement home, do you play for the other residents of the home? And she said, oh, absolutely, no way. And her press person / agent who was there with her said, oh, absolutely, we don't play for free.
Pamela, I wanted to ask you, could you compare her, what would the Aussie, American, UK, Swedish equivalent be if you think of similar quirky national icons? Because
Elvis Presley was a woman who didn't drink. She's someone, I have to say, before I was assigned this story, I have to admit, by one of your brilliant editors, and I hadn't heard of Yvette Horner. But once I started asking people, do you know who this accordionist is? Everyone immediately said, oh yeah, of course. She's sort of part of the water in France.
There is this whole culture that I've only ever really seen in France, which is this, the fact that you have the so-called La Chanson Française, and then you have Musette, which is what Yvette Horner does, and it is a whole genre of music which is so well respected that generations sort of sit down and absorb it and enjoy it, and it dates back hundreds of years back to the old music halls.
But
it's something that the French take immense pride in. So this lady, as far as I can remember, the only thing that I'd ever heard about her was that she'd played on the Tour de France in the 1950s. Is that true?
That's right. She's known for standing on the top of a car and playing the accordion for about 14 hours at a stretch. She sort of made it into a sport, playing the accordion. And ever since those sort of 11 years when she played every single Tour de France, she has been a household name.
Well, why don't we have a little listen to what this lady is capable of? I think we have a little bit of Yvette Horner coming up, don't we? And for those of us who've just joined us, you really are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 from London. You haven't just accidentally stumbled onto the soundtrack of a Jacques Tati film. I'm joined by Pamela, who's on the phone from Paris, and she's a lady who went and spoke to a lady called Yvette Horner, who was responsible for that quite astonishingly chirpy piece of music that we've just heard called Le Dénicheur, which apparently means the snooper. Pamela, that is an example of Musette. Can you explain to the non-fans what it might just be?
Well, if you've ever seen a movie where a couple is holding hands walking along the banks of the Seine, the soundtrack to that with the accordion music in the background is Musette. It's sort of iconic, almost cliched French music. It's not something that people kind of sit around and listen to in their homes anymore, but they have a real kind of soft spot in their hearts for it. It's kind of nostalgic French music, even for French people. But it's had kind of a revival in the last, I'd say, 10, 15 years, and these balls, these big sort of dance hall parties with live music that Yvette Horner used to play at, those were her gigs in her day, have come back in a way, and that young people, kind of young hipsters in Paris, will go to the 19th arrondissement and go to a ball on a Friday night.
So if I stumbled off the Eurostar in about 2 hours' time, the first thing that you'd do would take me to a bar Musette. What kind of people go there?
Well, it's sort of a mix of, there's a sort of gay scene, there's sort of a, I haven't actually been to one, I have to, full disclosure.
Shame on you, Pamela, I thought you'd be there every night. I would be, certainly.
and there's also, people, an older crowd, I think it's a blend, of people who know the music from growing up, you know, 60, 70 years ago. So it's I think people in France, like people everywhere, are looking for what's authentic now with the internet and technology and all that. And in France, Musette and Yvette Horner kind of serve that function in a very sweet way.
Tyler, would you ever be tempted to put a bit of Musette onto our playlist at Monocle 24?
Listen, if it could replace the Alpines and Drive, then I'd be all for it. Maybe just in case we didn't have enough, we should have just one more listen. This says it's a slightly more chilled out version than what we heard. So I'm very intrigued, and I can't wait to listen to Le Canary. That was Yvette Horner playing or killing that poor canary.
She's a talented girl, she really is. I think we're being disrespectful to the great grand French tradition of La Musette.
Pamela, are you still there? Did you nod off? Are you still there?
No. I was enchanted.
Good.
Not sleeping.
So what was this brilliant lady like to talk to then?
Well, you know, she's 88. She's, not at her, at her best. I mean, at one point, the photographer wanted to take a picture of her with the accordion, and it's a heavy instrument. We had to pick it up and put it gently on her lap. But there was this beautiful moment when she had the accordion on her lap, and suddenly she went from an 88-year-old who was kind of trying to get through the interview to this young, vibrant woman, and she sort of tilted her head to the side, and she didn't actually play it, but she sort of pushed the button and looked like she was in reverie somewhere, and it was like it was clear that was what this woman was meant to do, and she was going to do it until the very end. So it was quite an inspiring meeting for me to see someone.
I think that you set up the image brilliantly, because there clearly she's used to being in the presence of a camera, because there's something quite electric actually about that image when you flip through the magazine, and it's not just the hair color that you refer to, but there's a real twinkle in her eye, and you feel very engaged. It's a very happy picture.
She also, I mean, I was struck by how much she wants to work still.
Does she still work?
She does still work. She is making an album, although she's been making it for many years now. But she, you know, she sort of treated the interview a bit like a job interview. She kept saying, "I'll play with anyone. I'll go anywhere." You know, she's not letting go at all.
That's astonishing that she has such commitment to it. Do you think that actually she couldn't survive if she didn't have her accordion to play along with?
Well, I have to say, everything in her apartment was shaped like an accordion. From the ashtrays to the sort of curtain rods and the entire living room was covered with memorabilia and sort of accordion paraphernalia.
Pamela, you missed the bigger design story here.
Sort of mid-century modern accordion.
Brilliant.
Well, Pamela, thank you very much for that. One last question. What do the other people in the nursing home think of her? You know, are they fed up with accordion night and day?
I think they're quite in awe to have a celebrity on the premises.
I bet they
probably
are.
The only one.
I bet they are. Pamela, thank you very much indeed. And you don't need to send us any more of those CDs of Yvette Honour, but thank you very much for your generosity. It's an incredibly nice, very nice gesture of you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back right after this.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run around the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK time, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here at Studio One, here in London, on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Tyler. There's an alpine villa in Italy that we want to take you to now, where they grow apples, lots of them. Enough, in fact, to satisfy 10% of Europe's needs.
And in the middle of the valley, a small company is quietly making its presence felt in global retail. It has nothing to do with apples, but if you've been into a shop on any European high street, you'll have probably picked up a product off a shelf made by the Schweitzer family.
The Schweitzers are an example of the small family business, which is currently keeping Italy's economy alive, just about. Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, has been to visit them, and he joined us on the line from Milan now. Good evening, Ivan. Tell us about the Schweitzers. What are they like to meet?
Hi, Emma. Hi, Tyler. Schweitzers are a classic Italian family business that I've gotten to know now covering various stories here in Italy. Bernard Schweitzer, he's the third generation, and his grandfather started out making these refrigerators for the butchers in the valley there, Val d'Aosta. And slowly they were providing delis and butcher shops, and they grew into this business because besides the apple orchards, there's lots of lovely forests there, and they can build wonderful wood shelves, and they saw an opportunity, and they've now parlayed that into €100 million a year business, providing shelving for companies such as Waitrose in the UK, La Rinascente in Italy, and also lots of supermarkets, hypermarkets, cash and carry in Germany, also Migros in Switzerland.
So what is making these shelves so successful? Because a shelf is surely a shelf.
Well, there is a shelf, and then there is a Schweitzer shelf. Very sturdy, because these take a lot of beating, not only by the customers, but Bernard Schweitzer was telling me that it's also when they're unloading and loading merchandise. He says a lot of times the employees are, if you take, for example, the cash and carry, they're loading in lots of bulk items, and they can damage things very, very quickly, dents and things. So you have to be careful there.
Ivan, do you think that a part of the Schweitzer's success, because they've definitely cornered a market, I guess, is some of it down to the fact that they also offer a complete design solution? Because it's not like if you're Carrefour, for example, that you just say, okay, we need some shelves, and you call them up. But, you know, here's a team which is also thinking about navigation in stores. They're thinking about elements of lighting, and, they're trying to, of course, be on trend when it comes to thinking about finishes and all of those things. So it strikes me as well that, in a time of so much cost cutting, when I'm sure a lot of major grocery store groups have said, well, do we even need an architecture department? That's probably where the Schweitzers are also making their margin, because they seem to be operating like consultants as well, no?
Yes, from the father seeing an opportunity, and that's been developing since the 80s, Bernhard Schweitzer has continued that. They've been doing consulting work with the layout of the store, so they bring you the shelving, also the counters, and the navigation around the store, so they optimize where things are so people will congregate not only to the things in the main aisles but also other areas of the food stations. And he was explaining to me all kinds of things they picked up working in different countries. People like to see food preparation, so they've incorporated that into, for example, there was a hypermarket in Dusseldorf, which they opened on the outskirts, and it's become a big success. On Friday night, people come, spend up to 2 hours there, and they were looking outside in the parking lot, the license plates of the cars, and there were cars coming from up to 60 kilometers, not only to do their shopping, get a lot of items in bulk, but also spend some time maybe in the wine shop. There's a food station, tapas, sushi. And so they've been showing supermarkets, cash and carry, and the others how to optimize the floor plan. So it's not just shelving.
They're not just doing the shelving and the entire design, but they're doing it on quite a regular basis, aren't they? Because in contrast to what Tyler was saying in terms of big supermarkets actually restricting and reducing their investments, the Schweizers renew their product every 2 years, don't they? How do they sustain themselves?
Well, they have. They also, besides food retail, they have a business in fast fashion. So they provide, for example, H&M with various shelving. They also do furniture, various furniture solutions for department stores and some clothing store chains. And there, for example, the fast fashion market demands turnover. Not only in every month there has to be a new collection of clothes, but also how the store looks. They have to be fresh because it's fashion.
I was also just maybe to Emma's comment and question as well. I met with some of their clients as well. Now, the Schweizers, I think, maintain quite a nice lifestyle up in and around Merano. And there's two parts to this. They're definitely able to seduce their big clients because you really have to make a pilgrimage. There's nowhere that you can fly to. I guess if you're a well-oiled grocery store group, then maybe you could go by helicopter, but otherwise it is a real schlep to get up there. But when you get there, it's incredibly beautiful, and as we were saying in the intro, enchanting amongst all those orchards. But also, you talk to their clients, the Schweizers aren't exactly cheap, because
right.
here you are in the heart of Südtirol. You're in, of course, the heartland of the EU, but what you get is great quality, and I think that there's no question that their clients realize that that comes with a price tag, right, Ivan?
No, exactly. It's a beautiful location. It is difficult to get there. There is basically one road into the valley, and if you go during the harvest season, there are tractors going very slowly on the roads with the apple harvest. But it's idyllic, and they prefer to be based there. They don't want to move the operations. But they're very much on brand because they're there right just outside the factory. You see the forest. It's all there. It's very local. There's the river right next to it. They also have, because of that area, which is South Tyrol, which is used to be part of Austria up until World War I, part of Italy now, very multicultural, very cosmopolitan. They speak Italian, German, and English, almost everyone who I've met on my trips to Murano and that area there where Schweizer is based. And they're also very eco. So their factory, for example, is completely, there is no CO2. They have geothermal, they have solar. It's quite remarkable, even though it's hard to go and do a pilgrimage there, unfortunately.
Ivan, thank you very much for that. What we asked you before you came on and kindly joined us on Midori House here on Monocle 24 was that we asked you to choose some songs which would pretty much sum up what kind of lifestyle is can be led in Italy at the moment, if you're not Silvio Berlusconi, who appears to be on a car crash course for tomorrow. You have a song for us by a lady called Patti Pravo, don't you?
Yes, this is I've Gone Back for an Oldie from the 70s. It's Pensiero Stupendo. It's slightly naughty song. The lyrics are a bit ambiguous. It talks about a love triangle, and it was actually written for a French singer, but in the end Patti Pravo had great success with it, and she gives this sort of like a chanteuse. It's very seductive, I think.
E tu, e noi, e lei, fra noi, vorrei, non so, che lei, o no, le mani. de su pensiero stupendo nasce un poco strisciando si potrà o prima o poi poteva cadere sai.
That was Pensiero Stupendo by Patti Pravo, the choice of Ivan Carvalho, Milan correspondent, who's still on the line, aren't you, Ivan? Just explain to us again why you loved her, because why you like Patti Pravo so much.
Well, I just it was used recently in a for a watch ad, and it's very, very seductive, the song. And I'm a big fan of the music from the 70s, the 80s. Contemporary Italian pop music is not my cup of tea, let's say.
Quick question, Ivan. Who influenced who? Did Patti Pravo influence Bonnie Tyler, or did it go the other way?
I can't ask that. I think the question should be put to the great all-knowing Robert Bound, I think.
Okay, because there's definitely shades of Bonnie Tyler Italia there for sure. Anyway, I have to say thank you for raising the musical tone of the program. it was definitely heading in a southerly direction. you've also been speaking of going south. You were also down in Genoa for us recently.
Yes, just finishing the yacht show season. Genoa is the last show in the beginning of October. Just having a look around of where the trends are and how the industry is doing. Obviously, it's not an easy time for yacht makers.
Now, I was at the Cannes Yacht Festival last month, and the buzzword there, despite the opulence, was austerity. What does this mean, and what are they doing about it?
There's a lot more sober lines in the new models that are coming out. People are pushing these explorer yachts, so they're not these flashy yachts to do the famous milk run between Saint-Tropez and Sardinia. These are more eco-friendly yachts, spacious inside. One yacht maker, a very new yacht maker, just not even a year old, actually the first relationship with the engine room.
You know what? Actually, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll come back to that because we're at the top of the hour and we'll chat soon. That's it for all of us here at Midori House. We'll see you later on this evening.